Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Dublab.com, you just heard 1967's Silver Apples of the Moon. Beautiful, groundbreaking, far-out music from Morton Subotnick. And we're so very pleased and honored to have the man himself, Morton, in the studio here for the French folks out there, Morten, for the rest of us, Mort. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Doing good. Welcome to back to Los Angeles. I know you spent a lot of time here.
Yeah.
You're currently a bit further east.
Yep. As far as you can go east before you drown, yeah. Until global warming, then we'll all be there.
Exactly. We'll have to converge a bit more in the middle. And you were actually born in Los Angeles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was born in Boyle Heights.
Wow.
Most people didn't know where it was then anyway, but yeah, that's where I grew up.
Great. And this piece of music that we just heard, Silver Apples of the Moon, released in 1967 on Nonesuch Records, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty far out sounds. What was the reaction to the music?
Well, it was a big hit. It was really amazing. It was, the Buchla had been around for not very long. Mogic came out just about that time. And so there wasn't anything quite like it. And I had a publishing contract at the time with my music, and the ordinary expectation of a record was, of your music, was that they would sell a couple hundred, and the publisher always took 50% because they figured they were doing so much work for you, you know, and they could collect a little money on the side there. But of course, the publisher had nothing to do with it. They didn't publish anything, so when the piece, but I allowed the contract because I didn't expect to sell anything, you know, it was nice someone wanted to record it, but it, and it wasn't recorded. I actually made it. They didn't record anything. I made it in my studio and handed it. It was a whole new concept.
How did that connection come? How did Nonesuch, how did they connect with you?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know how it came about physically, but I don't know how they got to doing it. But probably a little hard for you and other people to visualize what was going on then. But you know, records were not a big thing, and I got out of high school in 1951 and was interested in the music of Webern and Schoenberg, and there was one recording of Webern and one score available, and the score wasn't the same as the recording. It was a different piece.
Wow.
So to get to know anything was really, you know, it was not an easy thing to do. They were just not out there. And by the end of the 50s, it was a little better, but not a whole lot. So we're talking only a few years after that, but it was a big thing that happened at that point around 1960 with records, long playing records, and the whole thing. And it really felt like a new world was about to approach, but not everybody saw that. Mm. And so I was giving lectures. I was doing, to help make a living, I was doing lectures for symphony societies and things like that. And I talked about the fact that because of the recording was going to get better and better and more in the home, and the Beatles hadn't hit yet. You know, nothing had really materialized quite yet. And I said, eventually, I knew this wasn't going to happen, but I even told the people I didn't think this was going to really happen, but what really should happen is that we shouldn't be, when this happens with this recording thing, we shouldn't be replacing musicians on records. We shouldn't take a Beethoven string quartet and record it forever. Mm. It should just stay on 78s, you know, so it never replaces a performance. But what we should do with the new medium is commission works, you know, have people make things for a record. The record should be the medium, not the recorded medium, but the real medium. Mm. And it should be, and I, even on Silver Apples the Moon, in the back I say, this is the new chamber music, you know, the recording. So I was in my studio in New York every night working, and the rock bands were just down the street and they played, and they'd come over. Many the people would come over at night, and it was sort of a little, you know, a community. And around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, this guy walks in, like everybody else walked in, except he wore a suit, and he gave me the talk that I just gave you, that I was giving to people. He repeated it almost intact, and I thought it was a joke. I thought he was kidding. He said, "We're going to commission you to be the first person to do it." And I said, "Look, I'm really busy. Why don't you just leave and leave me alone?" So he left. He told me the name of his record company, Nonesuch, and I'd never heard of it. So I thought it was, Nonesuch is kind of a weird name for a record company. Mm-hmm. So I went home that morning, 6 in the morning as usual, and try to get rested before I got the kids off to school. And I usually took a nap around 6 o'clock before they got up, and I had a Brandenburg concerto that I played to put me to sleep, and it was a Nonesuch record.
Wow.
Because I bought it because it was cheap. I didn't mm-hmm. I didn't know, and so I tried to reach them all day long. I thought, oh my God, it was real. And and I couldn't reach them. They didn't have a phone number. It was Electra Asylum, and I didn't know that. So
that's a way to keep demand up, though. You tell them to, you know, get going, get lost.
Yeah, right. That was great. That was wonderful. And so that night, he came back, and I was about to say, oh, and he offered me $500. Mm-hmm. And I was about to say, you know, I made a mistake. And he said, don't kick me out again. He said, put his hand up. He said, we've had a meeting. We met today, and we've upped it. We'll give you $1,000.
Wow.
And so I said, okay, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was it. That was so rough. So how they got to me, I don't honestly know.
Yeah.
I guess I was fairly well known at that time already. I was doing a lot of multimedia and stuff, but didn't feel like I was well enough known that someone would do that.
Yeah.
You know, I was quite surprised. But, you know, looking back, I was doing something that no one else was doing. I didn't know that. I mean, I was just doing what I did.
Can you give us a sense of what the studio was like for folks? You mentioned Buchla, and Don Buchla developed a synthesizer system that you used for Silver Apples
right.
and the Moon for the recording of that. Can you give us a sense of what that looks like and what it was, you know, for folks out there who might not have an idea?
Right. Well, they can look it up on the web now, so mm-hmm. they can get pictures of it. It was, we started around 1962. I had this vision of it was a tape center. Mm-hmm. We had started the tape center. There's a book now. I think it's called San Francisco Tape Music Center and the Counterculture of the 60s. It's a very good book, and they really spent a lot of time talking to all of us and really getting a picture of it. And so we had started this tape center, Ramon Sender and myself, and looked a little bit like this place right here, except your equipment's a lot better. At that point, we were essentially cutting tape. I mean, if you wanted to make a crossfade between two sounds, you took the two sounds each on a piece of tape, held one over the other, and if it was 2 seconds long, you'd be cutting roughly 30 inches of tape at a diagonal straight across with a hard edge. Mm. So it wasn't exactly ideal for what people had in mind. Mm. And so I had this idea of, I called it an electronic music easel. I don't really think I called it, maybe I just called it a music easel. I don't even know if the word electronic was in it. But the idea was a black box that would be cheap enough for everybody to have in their homes. I didn't know what it was going to look like. And put an ad in the paper in the San Francisco Chronicle for an engineer, no money, but for someone who would come along and help us make this thing. And several people came, and then Don Buchla arrived, and out of an ad in the paper.
Wow.
And we got along right away, and he went off, and we gave him some ideas, and he came back the next day with something, with batteries and something, and it made sound, and it worked.
Wow.
And So he said, I don't think this is the right way to go with it. I think, you know, and he really introduced us to the world of, we knew about the transistor, but I didn't know really what it was. And he gave us the new world of what this whole thing could be, voltage control, which no one had used really yet at that time.
Wow.
But it was being used in military and other places. So we worked with it. And it was mostly Don and myself. I gave him the music side of it, and it ended up to be a box about I guess about 2.5 feet tall, not quite square rectangular, but maybe a little taller than it was wide. I don't know the exact, but nothing huge, and. A bunch of knobs, and they were all modules. It was already modular right from the start, the concept, so that you could put it together any way you want. And I still had the idea that this was an easel, you know, that you would have in your house. And so the functions of each knob would be a function of some aspect of making things. But I didn't have the idea that it was a keyboard. We didn't have a keyboard. It was not something you would play, because if you wanted to play, you would get a piano. A piano plays, yeah. You know. You don't want to. This was a whole, very much like what you're doing, you know, yeah. Now. It wasn't DJ, but it was using knobs and a little touch plate keyboard that where you could change the voltage mm-hmm. by pressure and control of various sorts. So we divided everything up into categories of. One was a sound thing, something that produced sound, and for that we had assigned saw, square wave. And Don wanted to know how accurate it should be, so I called my friend. I was a clarinetist. I was playing with the San Francisco Symphony at the time, and I called my friend Nate Rubin, the violinist, and he came over, and I said, "Nate, tune your violin and play. And when it gets out of tune." When it gets out of tune that I can recognize, we'll stop. And I timed it. It was about 15 minutes. I said, "Don, if you can build an oscillator that'll stay in tune as long as a good violin, we're okay." So
wow.
That was it. And it was a really fortuitous thing, because it turned these things into very cheap objects. When Moog went and made his later, he made it like an engineering thing from a radio station. So you had to pay at that time $400 or $500 for a Moog oscillator, which is not much money now, but it was a lot then. Ours were in roughly $50 for two.
Wow.
So, you know, it was a module of two oscillators for $50. The idea was that everybody should have one. I wasn't going into business. We weren't going to sell them. We just wanted it for the studio. But Don was going to go into business. So, you know, we were trying to make it so that everybody in the world could have one of these things. That was the real vision. So there were oscillators, and then the oscillators had voltage-controlled inputs for the waveform and for frequency modulation. That was before frequency modulation, but it was, you know, it was an early form of frequency modulation. So you, and then there were input devices. There was a sequencer. Don introduced us to the sequencer, and we wow. put three voltage controlled outputs from each stage of the sequencer, and the sequencer could feed back into itself. That was the point at which I realized what we were dealing with at this point. It really turned into an analog computer, because, for instance, we made envelope generators, but they weren't associated with amplitude. So when Moog did it, he thought of it as a musical instrument, so he linked everything together. But this wasn't. This was totally isolated, because immediately when I saw that sequencer, and I thought you could take the output of every position of the sequencer, throw it back into the pulse generator, and change rhythms on the spot, and change positions, and then by linking two of them and making them out of sync, 116 and 115, you would have 16 times 15 voltages, six positions each. I mean, it was just mind-boggling.
Infinite possibilities, and it continues today. You know, we have people come in here using Buchla modular synthesizers and playing music, and you can, you know, it's wild.
Oh, you've seen
wild.
It, so you know. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. And then the other thing about it, well, I'll get to that in a minute, the cables, we should talk about that. But so the envelope generator was, in my mind, an interpolator of voltages from one point to another and back again or to another place, which I immediately saw could be panning. Mm-hmm. We didn't have much in the way of filtering, but pitch change. And immediately we talked about the idea there should be a voltage modifier so that you could invert voltages. You could condense them from zero, instead of zero to 100, zero to 100 percent would be, a half a volt, so that whereas it goes to one place, it would go whoop all the way, mm-hmm. another place would go whoop, and at the same, but the same voltage. So, and the other one goes backwards or upside down. This is a whole bank of these little things with knobs where you sit there and route these things. And then the other thing, because we weren't, again, that early notion that the control didn't have to be perfect. It didn't have to be, this was not a scientific object or a perfect musical instrument to play Bach. This was a new thing, and it would be imperfect, like a paintbrush is imperfect.
Yeah.
And it's nice the way metaphor moves into that. And I was thinking of finger painting even. Yeah. So,
well, would you relate that to the waves, the waveforms, the saw wave, the sine wave? Would they be different types of brushes or different painting tools?
I would have loved it if we could have had something other than pure sine tones and square waves. But they were in fact the object. And then the control of them was the imperfect.
Got it.
We really couldn't do much with that at that time. Later one could. Well, that's why it had FM. You could modulate it, turn it into those kinds of things you were listening to.
Thinking of...
But wait, let me just finish this. Sure. Because that led to the fact that we did not need to use shielded wiring for the voltage control. That meant we could use banana plugs. And this was... The banana plug carries the voltage you can put through your body. It's so low. Mm. So you could stack... You could come out of a thing that went from 0 to 100% in 2 seconds and take a stacking thing out of it and send it to 20 places at the same time. The Moog, because he did it so well, the irony there is that they were all shielded cables. They were all, so if you wanted to go to 2 places at the same time, you had to build an object that will multiply it without losing any, because he didn't want to lose any, anything. He was a real engineer, and he, lovely guy and beautiful machine, but very different concept in dealing with it.
Yeah.
Did that sort of factor into performances at the time?
Yeah.
The fact that things were
absolutely
unpredictable?
That were what?
That things were just sort of unpredictable in general.
Well, they weren't really unpredictable. That's carrying a little.
So there was some.
Oh, there was predictability, but it wasn't perfect.
Right.
There was unpredictable at a small level. I mean, if I wanted to go, it would always go, but somebody would go,
right. It's a small sort of imperfection.
And that was human. That felt good to me. But it wasn't like you didn't know what was going to happen. And
definitely brings a sense of musicianship to the sounds.
That's right. It was feeding back. If you're a conductor and you bring your hand down, it's not never exactly the same, but it's so close that you don't worry about that. Mm-hmm. And you're fed off of the difference. So that helps you. You're conducting and the tempo, they're doing a slightly different tempo, you adjust to it, and that gives you a different, it feeds back to both people. There's things, and there was always a kind of feedback there.
Right.
But it was a machine, so it was, it was the beginning of interacting with machines in a very different way. And I kind of, you know, sometimes like the getting out of tune would create beats and things, and that would give you ideas. Right. So in that sense, it was unpredictable, but not in the sense it was like chance, and you never knew quite what. Some people thought of it that's what we were doing, that it was just, you know, whatever happens, just happens, but that really wasn't the case.
Was it performances, were they sort of scripted, or did you do both improvisational performances and scripted performances,
No. Performances. Scripted only in the sense of general stuff.
A metaphor, and, score.
Yeah, metaphorical or timeline, like, you know, first there's going to be something very quiet, and then there'll be something,
right.
But not really a time to it or anything. And then I would develop a patch, which was this probably doesn't exist in any form anymore. But I would develop a patch because you couldn't repatch quickly.
Right.
So I would develop a patch that I could get a lot of stuff out of, mm-hmm. that I could do something quiet, and I could do something by changing this or changing that. You practiced, but right. you didn't practice the piece. You practiced manipulating a patch, and if it didn't quite work right, I may even at some point, so getting ready for a big performance, have Don make a new module,
right.
you know, for something that I couldn't get something to do,
right.
and he would make a new module for that.
What was the size of the equipment that you were bringing out?
Well, when I went to New York, he made me a duplicate of the studio that we had in San Francisco because I, and, you know, that was what I worked with. And I think it was at the beginning, it was two boxes. And as I said, the box, I don't know, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I would guess you could get probably about 15 to 20 modules in a box.
Wow.
So I had two boxes and to start with. Then I got three because I was also controlling lights and things like that. And I would ask him to make more things for me. So by the end of the first year, by the time Silver Apples was done, or I was really working on it, I probably had three boxes full. But they would easily fit on a 6-foot table with room to put other things on.
So as you were performing the music, you were also controlling the lighting effects as well?
Yeah.
Wow. With the same
equipment. Wow. He built a silicon rectifier, which changed the low voltage into high voltage. And you know, you could and took light bulbs and cut, or the bulbs of projectors, and cut one of the wires and put it through the silicon rectifier, I mean through the not the silicon rectifier, but the sequencer or the whatever I was using, so that the voltage from that would, it was like a dimmer, like a dimmer that you buy in the hardware store, but it was run by the computer, so I could control the bulbs of projectors, and then I took 16 millimeter silent film and took the sprocket holes on the side that would go over the playback head, which would produce a pulse. So I had various variable controlled projectors, so I could use the computer, the booklet to control the speed of the, or use a knob to control the speed of the projector.
Wow.
But it was sending a pulse, so I could line the sequencers up with the frames of the films, so things would line up and be absolutely synced. It was like an early SMPTE code.
What types of venues and audiences were you playing for?
Well, it changed. I didn't do anything public until the late 60s because it didn't, you know, until after Silver Apples. Silver Apples was done, the show we're doing at Red Cat is a piece with Ann Halperin, a big dance piece that we collaborated on. When it was done in New York in 66, I was working on Silver Apples of the Moon. So a lot of that was there. Some of it was live, some was on tape. Things that I'd recorded, and a lot of what the second side turned out to be was going all the time. We do that Wow. I mean, they're doing it here. And then I was also doing the Electric Circus. I started the Electric Circus. I was the artistic director of that huge multimedia discotheque. And Silver Apples, again, before it came out, was started with Heartbeats and, you know, went through the whole thing for almost an hour.
Yeah.
And some of that, a lot of that was on tape at that point because its end result was going to be a record. So it eventually all got taped. And I never did it wholly. As I'm going to do it for the first time as a live performance next season.
Wow.
But it'll be a remix. It'll be something quite different, but it'll have all the elements of it that I'll do live with a computer. But my live performances didn't start with the booklet until after I was already doing records. So I got well known almost immediately, and I started going out. And the venues were, well, I'll tell you about one. It was really wonderful. I was using lights, and I had Tony Martin, the light artist, painter light artist, was working with me very closely in New York. And we would go to universities, and because there was an Electric Circus, we were doing things there, and then there's quite a bit of notoriety, so we were going around to different venues, mostly university-type situations. And we went to Colgate and trying desperately to earn a living, too, you know, during this time, and nobody was paying anything. So my famous Silver Apples of the Moon was on top of the charts for a year. I got $2,000 that year. So, you know, it was not like major stuff that made us wealthy or anything. So we were trying to do things like commercials and things to do it. And we were in Colgate. We were doing two performances. You know who Marianne Amershay was, right?
Sounds familiar,
she just died.
Sure.
But she was with me, Serge Tereppnin. You know, a lot of people who ended up becoming part of the scene were actually helping me, and they all came with me to Colgate, and Tony was doing the lights, and we did this thing. Moog was at the concert.
Wow.
I think he lived near there at that point, or I'm not really sure. But the first night, we did the thing, and after it was over, you know, I'm getting standing ovations here. We were just talking about that. When the thing was over, there was a lot of booing and wow. Some applause, and some people really loved it. And one guy came up on the stage with a very red face and veins on the side of his thing bulging out, and he threatened to kill me because I was destroying music, and guys had to grab him. He was coming to hit me, and we got out of there, and we had another performance the next night, and we were getting all together for everybody who was there $500 for the two nights that we had to pay for our motel. And even in those days, that wasn't very much money. So we get back to the motel, and there's a note, from a message for me, a note under the door that this guy in New York had, call him immediately, he has a commercial for me. And I really didn't know how to do this. I mean, I was doing commercials, and the pay was enormous. I mean, it was just really unbelievable for doing nothing. And so I called him on the phone, and in those days you could find a, you know, the switchboard was closed, and you had to go out and find a phone booth. I call him, and he said, "Hey, Morty," he said, "I have a Dream Whip commercial for you. It's a 30-second commercial. How much do you want?" And I won't go through the whole story, but at this point, I kept upping the price because nobody ever said no. So I said, okay, the only thing I knew was you do it, and if you get one price for doing it, and then another price if they use it. So at this point, it was $7,000, and then another $7,000 if they used it. And he said, oh, that's perfect. And that was the highest. That was twice what I had asked for the last one. It was still, I couldn't find the top of it. He said, well, I need it tomorrow. And I said, I can't give it to you tomorrow. I have a concert tomorrow night. He said, oh, man, he said, I'm sorry, but if we don't have it tomorrow, it's over. So I said, well, I can't do it. So here I'm out on the stage. Someone's threatening to kill me.
Yeah.
I'm going to end up paying money at the end of this thing because it isn't, you know, it's not going to pay for everybody. And I'm turning down $14,000 to be killed. But it was what I did, so I did it. And we get on the stage, and the second night was fine. People liked it. You know, it was nobody there threatening to kill me. And the third day, going back, knowing I had given up $14,000, we're driving this borrowed car. We didn't have enough money to rent one. And it was an early version of what became automatic transition. It was fluid something or another. Mm-hmm. And all forward gears went out. And we were about 5 miles outside of Colgate. We had to back up along the highway to get back into Colgate, back into the main street, and back up a driveway that led into a garage.
Oh, man.
And I'm with my head out the window. Tony is driving, and I'm saying, no, to the left. And when we got there, I suddenly got to the garage, got up, we got out. All of a sudden, I had this I've only had it once before in my whole life, this kind of, I guess you call it an epiphany, but my whole body went cold. And I suddenly saw clearly, everything was so clear, and I started to laugh. That's what, when I see the big guy in Tibet, what do they call him? The
Dalai Lama.
The Dalai Lama. He's always laughing. And I've always understood it because I just started laughing. And then the garage mechanic laughed, and then Tony laughed, but they didn't know what they were laughing about. We were holding ourselves up, wow. And you know, stuff coming out of your nose, and I mean, really, really tough laughter. Finally, gathering my strength, I said, they didn't know what they're laughing about. And I said, you know what? I suddenly know what I want to do. I want to go this way, pointing to against the traffic while everybody's going fast in the other direction. And because the 14,000 had really confused me.
Yeah.
And I realized I really loved what I did. I didn't care if someone wanted to kill me. Wow. And it was so clear that the rest of my life was sort of, you know, clarified. A lot of people have given up for money, you know,
yeah. Uh-huh.
And that would have been a very easy thing at that point. It could have been that moment that said, well, hell, I don't want to do this. If I can get all this money, why don't I just do that? But it was so clear, and I've never in my life ever been sorry about that. That was really a very, you know, really great thing. So I get back to my studio, and I get a phone call from this guy, and he said, they gave us an extra 24 hours.
Wow.
What a confusion that was. Yeah. I turned around in my seat. I hung up the phone, not even knowing whether that was good or bad. I looked at my equipment, and I thought about this moment. Turned around and called him back. I said, I can't do it. And I didn't want to be tempted anymore. I felt so good. I didn't want... It was almost like, you know, someone had given me something bad to eat or something. And I said, I can't do it. He said, why? I said, I think you'd say I've got a sickness. He said, well, how long do you think it'll take to get over it? I said, I hope I never get over
wow.
it.
Wow.
And that was the end. I got a couple more calls, turned them down. That was it. Never did another one after that.
Wow. That's
not because I didn't believe in them. I mean, I didn't care. I really didn't have a political view. It wasn't that I thought it was bad to do commercials or anything like that. It was just personally, it was that clarification that purification, in a way, at that moment, was it, and I wanted to stay that way.
Wow. That's a beautiful thing to have arise and be able to grasp onto.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to catch that sickness.
Yeah. Maybe we should jump forward from 1967 to, I believe, 1978.
I think 78.
Cloudless Sulfur.
Right. That was my last. The Silver Apples was my first, and I knew this was going to be my last record. I was going to go on to other things. I'd done what I wanted. So this, the dance, which you're going to play, was my swan song to vinyl. And
wow.
And it's a kind of celebration. I mean, that's why I'm playing it. It's very, I don't know how much you're going to play. If you don't play the whole thing, you should play toward the end of it, because that's where the whole thing happens.
Maybe we can we'll do a little fast forward, jump into the future. It's great to see this photo here, seeing the synthesizer and tape machines, analog heaven here. Where was this the photograph taken? Was this in New York? Or?
No, that's my studio. Actually, that's not my studio. That's that's the opening of CalArts.
Wow.
That's one of my students there in the studio.
Were you at CalArts in the early years?
I started it.
Wow.
The team that came in to start it in 1969.
Incredible. Incredible. Staying true to what you believe in and then spawning other action
in
people.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful. Well, let's listen to a bit of Sky of Cloudless Sulfur. And we have Morten Subotnick here in the Dub Lab studio. So happy. When we get back, we'll tell you about a concert happening tonight and tomorrow night at Red Cat. In the meantime, you could go to redcat.org, find it on the calendar, and read a bit up on that as you bliss out to this music, Sky of Cloudless Sulfur, Morten Subotnick on Dub Lab. Thank you. Yes. Seems like by 1978 you had the sequencing down pretty solid.
Yeah, well, actually, this isn't sequenced.
Oh, no?
No. It is sequenced, but in a very different way. It has a steady pulse. By this time, Columbia Records had given me a 16-track tape recorder to work with.
Yeah.
And so I had a steady pulse that I could do it live, but it wouldn't sound like this. I mean, it would be thinner in texture. So I put the steady pulse, which is very fast, it was like on one track of the 16 tracks, but filtered so that with a particular frequency that I could easily filter. And get that information out on a voltage-controlled envelope follower so I can get a pulse. It came out and went back into it ran the sequencers. Now, the sequencers were set up. I think I had three sequencers at that point. They were set up so that, then I could divide it up into half. I used prime numbers, so I first broke it down so I got, instead of it was and then divided that up into counts of two of them, three of them, five, seven, 11, and 13, so that the beats would interact in different kinds of ways. And then I using different keys for each one of them, I could control. By pressing slightly on one of them, it would go, and then another. Wow. And it was all one big long chord that was in there. So it could go on this one, it would go, this one would go, and then, and I had all these different things. I had, you know, 100 of these combinations, and if I just hit it, it would activate an envelope. Generator that would go tuck a tuck a tuck a tuck a tuck or tuck a tuck in things, so I could get these tunes and then, you know, tuck down 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 below, I'd get these other tunes and just play them with this touch plate keyboard, which both was producing voltage on the way I touched it and on which one I touched and how fast I hit it and so forth. And but what I was playing were not notes. They were these little these little, what now would call samples, but they weren't samples, mm-hmm. they were live.
And so that recording, were you actually playing that live to two-track tape, or how?
Yeah, what I did is, finally, when I liked what I got, I would record it on a couple of tracks of tape. But I still had the pulse up there, so everything would match up. Nothing would. It was again the SMPTE idea that I first used with projectors in the early days, where everything would be lined up by something, so whatever I did would stay within the context of a beat. And so that I did live, but for the recording, I took the live performances and just kept overdubbing, so to speak, but they were on different tracks. And as a matter of fact, the it was originally for 8 channels. It was commissioned by the J.B. Lansing Company when they opened a new building in the Valley. And
that's JBL.
JBL,
speaker.
Yeah. Wow. And so we had 4 speakers below and 4 speakers above, and sounds were flying, you know, these pulsing things were flying all over the place. And then reduced it. I did it all in stereo, so they would go to diagonal up, diagonal down. There were diagonals everywhere. And so that when it got reduced to stereo, it would still have that quality. Mm. And then recently I had a mode, did the original, well, in 4 tracks, not or surround sound, not 8. And I will be doing 6-channel versions of it live using the computer, just simulating what I did. Next season I'll be traveling with a remix of Silver Apples it'll be a different piece, but definitely use this section in it, because this was something I really loved. It was really great.
When did you make that transition to computers?
After this record.
Wow.
I gave all my analog stuff to Vladimir Usachevsky, and he went off with staying with analog. And I had, as you said, I had really gotten this down.
Yeah.
And I really could not imagine doing anything more beautiful than this. I mean, other people might, but I couldn't. This ending here was really special. You know, I listen to it, I still feel that
way.
That's great. And it's very unique. It's got its own quality. I mean, it's like a lot of things, but it's really special. And I was ready to go on to do something else. I never wanted to stay one place anyway, so I gave him all the equipment, and I didn't know what I was going to do at that point, because I had never used a computer. We were just coming into, you know, the Mac Plus had just come out. And so I got a commission, not a commission, I got a residency at MIT that year to come and just be an artist in residence, do whatever I wanted. And I didn't know anything about computers, so I didn't know whether to buy a PC or Mac. The PC, the IBM laptop had just come out, and not a laptop. They weren't laptops, but the table model, mm-hmm. the small one, and it's come out, and the Mac Plus had just come out, and I didn't know which way to go. I didn't know anything about anything with computers. But I heard that all the students at MIT had Mac Pluses, so I bought a Mac Plus.
And did they have musical applications on the Mac at that point, or mm-hmm. no?
Nothing.
You needed to program and get into.
No, there was nothing. So there was no MIDI yet. Was there MIDI? I think MIDI had just hit it.
Got it.
I think it happened, but it was just at the very beginning. And so I went and I try to conceptualize what I was going to do with the computer. I wasn't going to try to redo what I did with the analog of what I'm going to do. And I realized what I really wanted to do was to have some kind of interactivity between humans and the machine. That's something you really couldn't do in a large scale. So they had a very simple programming language, which actually turned into Max later, but it wasn't there yet. And something that I could learn quickly, because I was only there for a couple of months, and I didn't know any computer languages. So I I developed a kind of algorithm for the computer to be able to follow a conductor, given if you had an input. I just used tapping to do it, and to follow a score. The computer would actually follow the conductor in tempo and be able to know where it was at all times. And it took me about 5-6 weeks, and I did it, and with help. But I did the programming myself, but I, you know, had conferences with people, and I have great people there. I had, well, it was, you know, MIT. It was great. And so I did it, and everybody was pretty amazed, because I gave a demonstration at the end, and they took a look at the program I made, and one of the kids said, "I don't understand what you did." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Well, we learned, you know..." He said, "You've got everything all over the place. You think in forward and backward at the same time." He said, "You know, we learned that the only way you can program is go step by step, you know, so you know where you are all the time." And I didn't really understand what he said until I took it back home and I realized that I couldn't interpret my own sketches anymore. I didn't know what I had done. And then I understood what he said. It was just, you know, I did it so impulsively. I was just doing it all over the place. And
it's like
but
your
it worked.
Programming easel akin to your music easel.
Yeah, right. I was treating it like a music easel. And but it worked, and I realized that I had the capacity to do it. And so I moved to the computer at that point.
Tell us about a project that you currently have, the Creating Music.
The children's program. Well, that came about. I'm gonna
probably have to cruise out soon.
Yeah. It's a you know, when I said that it the early period I had the idea of a music easel, a sound easel. Shortly after that, I expanded the notion to little kids, because the metaphor just grew with me. It was a very true metaphor. I mean, it really worked. And so I had the idea that not only could people, you know, teenagers through adults, paint with it, but it literally could be a new way for people to understand and experience music at a very early age. I realized that we had evolved as a culture, as a human, as an animal, and we all had music, but we couldn't play with music without the creative ability, without performing it. You had to sing it or play it. And we had developed in recent time the ability to be able to go out of real time, like you can when you write a poem or you write a book, or you know, there's so many things that we do not in real time that the printing press brought about, you know, writing and things like that has changed what we can do and added a whole layer of expansion of human capacity. But that wasn't available in music before you already learned the music. It was a kind of, you understand what I'm saying? It's still true. It's like a, it's this paradox where you can't be creative because the only way you can get to it is by not being creative, by imitating something. And so it seemed to me that there would be a way with the new technology, with the computer. At first with the analog stuff, but that didn't work out at all. And then it was just, there was no way to get it into the hands of anyone. But with the computer, I finally realized it was finally going to be possible to do that. And that's what led me to it. So about 15 years ago now, I started setting up prototypes for an entire creative world for little kids starting at that time, 5 years old. They didn't think a kid under five could use a mouse, but now it goes down to 3 years old.
Yeah.
And now I have the whole series is finally done. And I'm trying to moved to a curriculum now that's a curriculum of learning music that is based entirely on creative. Everything comes from what you do, and so you never give up the creativity as you move forward.
Real human experience and allowing people to express and develop. That's really
beautiful. And it didn't have to be the music that we know. You know, in fact, I'd be surprised if it were the music that we know.
If you want to find out more, creatingmusic.com, check that out. And also, of course, you can go straight to mortonsubotnick.com. That's SUBOTNICK, mortonsubotnick.com. And let's tell people very quickly about the program this evening and tomorrow night. These are the last two nights of your concert series at the Red Cat in downtown Los Angeles.
Right.
What is happening?
Well, this was a work I collaborated with the dancer Anna Halperin. I was the composer for her company during the early 60s. And she had originally, the people before me were Lamont Young and Terry Rowley. They left for San Francisco, for New York and Paris, and around 1960, 61, something like that. And I took over the company when they left, and so I was with it until 66 or 67. Mm-hmm. And that's a long story. But we were doing, they were collaborative pieces. It was Anne's company, and she was, you know, she was the boss. But they were collaborations in that there was a lighting person, myself and Anne and several other people, but they're essentially a core of about three or four people. And we would feed off each other. And one thing would, for instance, I would, in this particular event, I had a thing, everything was called a dance. So there was a thing that was called the stomping dance. That was in 1963, probably, when that came up. Well, now stomp is a term that everybody uses, but stomp literally was, you know, not dancing. That was stomping on a bee, or, you know, stomping. And we were dealing with ordinary things and turning them into beautiful objects. So this was the stomp dance, right? Wow. So I developed a score that dancers could, and I taught the rhythms to them so that it wouldn't be fixed, but it had the possibility of starting with great symmetry and then growing into complex, like using a lot of sequencers or something, into a complex thing and built in, you know, stops and various things. And then Anne would then take it and choreograph it so that they were doing the dance, but where were they doing, how were they doing it, and what the attitude was about the stomping and things like that. So there's that kind of collaboration that went through the whole piece. I won't give you the details. You can see that. But the premiere that we did in New York, it had been done in various places in various forms. The premiere we did in New York recently, about 5 years ago, was, as I understand, some French historian or something said the night we did that was the night the postmodern dance began. Mm-hmm. So it excited people, and they invited Anne to recreate part of it several years ago at the Pompidou Center in Paris. And she said, well, you know, we really need to bring Morton. 'Cause they really didn't understand the notion of this collaboration.
Got so it.
She said, I really need to bring Morton along. So they called me, and we got in touch, and they brought me. So Anne and I went and did this in Paris, and that was a big success. We just did a little bit of it. And then one of the dancers in that performance formed a company, and with great effort, I mean, she did an amazing job, got money and the whole thing, and got these dancers from various parts of the world, six of them, and put up this whole thing together. I don't know if it's a recreation, sort of a recreation of that, of the whole thing, because it was much more than the part that we had done. So it's about 90 minutes, and came out and worked in the United States with us, and we flew to San Francisco to with where Anheuser Studio, and where are we? We're in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
Yeah. And
or are we?
and then they sent a young man, Sebastian, out to New York to work with me on the sound. And then Anne couldn't travel. There were a number of reasons at that point. She's almost 90 now. And so I went out with the company in France about a year ago last September, and worked for about 4 or 5 weeks with them. And then they did it in Lyon and then Paris and then toured Europe, and now they're on a U.S. tour. So that's what this is.
Great. So you've performed 2 nights already, and we have 2 more nights to go. If you're in Los Angeles, you should really check it out this evening at 8:30 p.m. and tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m. Do you know if there are tickets available still?
I don't know.
You can check it by visiting redcat.org, the wonderful people at Red Cat, and you can also call 213-237-2800. If you're elsewhere in the world, then teleport, cruise on down redcat.org, and you can enjoy this show, Morton Subotnick and Anna Halprin and Collad and guests, Parades and Changes, Replays, West Coast premiere. So some new visions and sounds for the people out here. And it's been a real pleasure.
It's a West Coast premiere.
West Coast
after the 40 years ago.
You know, re-premiere.
Re-premiere. Yeah. Maybe there's a period once you pass.
Think it's 39.
39 years. So you can re-premiere. And on a different day, a different note, we're presenting a show with Terry Riley and Kronos Quartet and Motmos. And I just was reading few years back and was hearing about your relationship with Terry Riley and kind of spawning of NC, and so maybe that's for round two. We can bring you back. But we're really thankful that you could make time to come down here and share some insight and inspiration with our listeners and give them a view into your creative world.
Great. Thank you
so much.
This is wonderful.
Thank you. Well, here's some music now from Maybe a Touch, which is on the left turntable. This is actually my most recent Subotnick acquisition, and been digging this so much. Stay tuned. It's dublab.com. We just had a conversation with Morton Subotnick, and we hope that your ears are alive and bright and buzzing with beauty. Stay tuned. Touch from Morton Subotnick. Thank you.
Thank you.